to week 7 of our time with How to Be an Anti-Racist. This is my second to last audio for you for this book. Hard to believe. Let's get started with a sacred pause, taking a moment to connect with ourselves and to take a slow and deep belly breath. Inhaling and exhaling. Nice work. Okay, today we are talking about chapters 14, 15, and 16. Lots to dig into here, so let's get started. Chapter 14 is about gender, and the main idea of this chapter is that because of the intersections between gender and racism, if we want to dismantle racism, we must also dismantle patriarchy. Right? This is not new. If we want to dismantle racism, we've learned we must dismantle capitalism. We must dismantle patriarchy and basically all of the oppressive systems that exist. He's just going through them one by one. So to dismantle patriarchy, we must have equal power between the sexes. To be anti-racist is to be feminist. And to be clear, being feminist doesn't mean working towards the goal of women having more power than men. Eber mentions that, and I think that's a common misconception in discussions about what it means to be a feminist. So Ibram's definition of feminism, and I think kind of the commonly understood without the misconceptions definition of feminism, is that it's not about reversing the hierarchy. Just like with all of these identities, we're not trying to reverse the hierarchy and just put somebody else in charge, switch who has the power and still have people underlings, right? We're aiming to get rid of the hierarchy altogether and to equalize power and resource allocation between the different groups. So Ibram writes about his own evolution in this process of understanding gender and gender racism and anti-racism. He admits that he arrived in his graduate program as a, quote, racist, sexist, homophobe. His ideas of gender and sexuality mirrored those of his parents. Although he grew up in a household where his dad was more emotional and affectionate than his mom, patriarchy also played a role in his upbringing. And I found this line especially interesting. Quote, my parents did not strictly raise me to be a black patriarch. I became a black patriarch because my parents and the world around me did not strictly raise me to be a black feminist. To me, this speaks volumes because it recognizes that if we want to instill something in ourselves or in others that goes against the dominant worldview, we must be very, very, very intentional and consistent about it, because otherwise the dominant worldview just seeps right on in there. So, you know, for those who have influence maybe over children or over organizations or over yourself, we're here for to do our own self-reflection too. If his parents didn't want him to be a black patriarch, and even view, they should have explicitly raised him to be a black feminist. There's just so much there. I really love that. So that's just something I'm keeping in mind in my own journey. Like, yes, I want to be anti-racist. I want to practice that more often than not, right? And so because that goes against the dominant worldview, I already knew this, but it's just a reminder even more. I must be very intentional and consistent about it, because otherwise what's out there, if it's just in the air we breathe, well, then we just keep taking it in. So this chapter goes on to spend quite a lot of time talking specifically about Black women. And Ibram quotes a scholar named Philomena Essed, who conducted a series of in-depth interviews with Black women in the United States and the Netherlands, and then published her reflections. And she wrote, quote, in discussing the experiences of Black women, is it sexism or is it racism? These two concepts narrowly intertwine and combine under certain conditions into one hybrid phenomenon. Therefore, it is useful to speak of gendered racism. And Ibram writes about how both white women and men of color have sometimes resisted the idea of gender racism to their detriment. When white women don't recognize that black women face an additional layer of oppression because of their race, and when men of color don't recognize that black women face an additional layer of oppression because of their gender, that hurts everyone involved. Because, of course, it allows the continued oppression of black women, and it prevents the resistors, so the white women or the men of color, from fully understanding their own oppression. Ibram argues that because black women face a double layer of oppression, at least, right, they could also have other identities that add on even more than that. But he writes that a theory for black women is a theory for humanity. No wonder black feminists have been saying from the beginning that when humanity becomes serious about the freedom of black women, humanity becomes serious about the freedom of humanity. It's a beautiful line, isn't it? And there's a lot there. Becoming serious about the freedom of black women. And then we come to the next chapter, which takes it even a level deeper. Chapter 15 is about sexuality. And in this chapter, Ibram moves us forward. And I think, you know, we get how this goes now. I would guess at this point, all of us would be able to guess at this, his main point, before even reading the chapter. But of course, I'll reiterate it anyway, because that's what we're here to do, right? To learn and to take in these ideas again and again. And when we get to the point where we are like, oh, I can guess what he's going to say. Hallelujah. We're catching on, right? But it doesn't mean it's time to stop. It means like it's a time to celebrate the fact that it's starting to integrate. It's starting to sink in. That is good news. And we want more and more of that. So let's continue exposing ourselves and discussing and letting it get deeper and deeper. So Ibram's main point here is that homophobia cannot be separated from racism. He writes that we cannot be anti-racist if we are homophobic or transphobic. We must continue to affirm that all Black lives matter, which includes the lives of poor transgender Black women, perhaps the most violated and oppressed of all the Black intersectional groups. And now I'll quote what Ibram writes about what it means to be queer anti-racist, except I'm going to substitute my identities instead of his, because it makes it more meaningful for me personally. And as you read the book, this part of the book, or listen to it, or listen to me now, I invite you to do the same, right? Think about this. This is not, I mean, it is, you are reading about Ibram talking about his work, but then of course you can turn the mirror on yourself, and I'm turning it on myself, like, oh, but for me doing my work, okay. To be queer anti-racist is to understand the privileges of my race, of my cisgender, of my heterosexuality, of their intersections. To be queer anti-racist, is to serve as an ally to transgender people, to intersex people, to the gender nonconforming, to gay people, to their intersections, meaning listening, learning, and being led by their equalizing ideas, by their equalizing policy campaigns, by their power struggle for equal opportunity. And then Ibram goes on. Actually, before I move on, we're going to talk more about like this understanding the privileges of each of our identities separately and then together when we get to the calls to action for this week. Okay, so Ibram also continues to talk about two of his grad school classmates who he introduced us to in the last chapter, Kayla and Yaba, who he greatly respected and feared because of how smart they were and because of how unafraid they were to speak truth to power. He writes, "Let's just say They ensured that when patriarchal ideas arose, when homophobic ideas were put out there, when racist ideas came and intersected, they would come for those ideas like piranhas coming for their daily meal. And Ibram admits that he never wanted to be their prey. But despite the fact that he admits to holding gender and queer racism ideas at the time, Kayla and Yaba saw something in him, and over time they invited him into long talks, which unnerved him, as it would me. I could relate to this, that recognition of like sort of looking in awe at people around me and being like, wow, you are like, I'm smart, but you're like another level smart. And I don't want to be on the other side of an argument with you. Ibram, with that kind of mentality, like if we can take, even though it's clear from this book that Ibram has a growth mindset, initially with these two women, he wanted to run away when they invited him into longer conversations because it was scary. And that's understandable. But he writes that it's best to challenge ourselves by dragging ourselves before people who intimidate us with their brilliance and constructive criticism. And he's grateful now that they didn't let him run away because he learned a lot from them. And one of the things I really loved about what Ibram shares that he learned from Kayla and Yaba is the way they talked about the issues. They didn't talk about people. They talked about systems, which of course is what this whole book is about. But something about the way he wrote it in this chapter landed for me a little differently or a little deeper. He writes, quote, "The radical Black queer feminism of these two women, detached homophobic from heterosexual, detached sexist from men and feminist from women, in the way I later detached racist from white people and anti-racist from Black people. They had a problem with homophobia, not with heterosexuals. They had a problem with patriarchy, not with men. Their ire was directed at policies and powers, not at people." I read that last line like it was, I was still quoting, but that was my line. So that's my sort of summary. And he covers this in just a few paragraphs, but for me, it gave me pause because it shed light on how I've been guilty many times of blaming a group of people instead of a power system. So for example, if a man was inappropriate with me, I'd sigh about men instead of patriarchy. And now I see that the latter is a more effective way, right? It's not only doesn't create defensiveness in men around me, but it also is actually pointing the finger at the problem. And then we get to like, okay, so if a white person is racist, and I've done this in the past 2 years, almost 3 years now that I've been learning so much about racism, I'd say, white people, instead of white supremacy. And, it, you know, that example kind of points back to how this book and white fragility are at odds in some ways, as is this book and some other books in the space, like why I'm no longer talking to white people about race. So that's something I'm continuing to sit with because I'm understanding more and more, like I can understand like, oh, white fragility is a thing. We look at white people through the lens of sociology and that the group of white people does tend to have these tendencies. And I can now Ibram's point here, but it makes a lot more sense to point our finger at the actual problem instead of the people who are perpetuating the problem, who sometimes perpetuate the problem, right? So this one more thing I wanted to say about this chapter is that a while ago, a few months ago, but it was during COVID, In Time magazine, I read this article written by a lesbian Latina woman who is American, and her partner is a Canadian person who uses they pronouns. And she was writing about, one, how they were separated. She was stuck in the U.S. Her partner was stuck in Canada, and they weren't able to see each other because of COVID and not being able to cross the border. So that was really hard. But then she was also writing about the her intersecting identities, and how in Quebec, where she usually I think she and her partner kind of divide their time usually between the U.S. and Canada. But when they're in Quebec, she's like, it's a very queer friendly space. Anywhere we go, you know, we feel safe. It's like nobody's going to look twice. However, she's usually the only person of color around. So then there's that difference, which then does cause people to look twice, right? And then she has to deal with racism. But then she goes like to Florida, where she's from, and she hangs out with her Latinx family and friends and the culture that she came from, and her brown skin, nobody thinks twice. The fact that she's gay, she has to deal with that, right? People have something to say about it. People have opinions, and that's not so accepted. So it kind of, for me, the story really, her experience, I appreciated her sharing it because it made me understand intersectionality, like how it actually plays out better. Like the more oppressed intersecting identities that one person carries, the harder it is for them to find any space where they feel truly safe and like they belong. That would be really hard. I'm just kind of sitting with how I probably have only the slightest idea of a sense of safety and belonging that I get to experience. It's unearned privilege because of my identities, because I don't face that really anywhere, almost anywhere I go. And then I think of like, oh, like if I were in the world and this, I go here and this one part of my identity is accepted and that feels good, but this other part isn't. And then I go here and the other part is accepted, but the original one isn't. How exhausting would that be over the course of a lifetime, right? How much would it wear me down? It just brings forth a lot of compassion. And it makes a lot more sense why, you know, if we can help the most marginalize the people with layers of intersecting oppressed identities, if we can lift them up, right? Lifting them up lifts everybody up. Okay, let's talk about chapter 16, which is about failure. I loved this chapter. It felt like a nice change of pace because Ibram shifts his focus to the topic of failure and its role in anti-racist efforts. He writes that to understand why racism lives is to understand the history of anti-racist failure, why people have failed to create anti-racist societies. To understand the racial history of failure is to understand failed solutions and strategies. To understand failed solutions and strategies is to understand their cradles, failed racial ideologies. Incorrect conceptions of race as a social construct, as opposed to a power construct. Of racial history as a singular march of racial progress, as opposed to a duel of anti-racist and racist progress. Of the race problem as rooted in ignorance and hate, as opposed to powerful self-interest, all come together to produce solutions bound to fail. And reading this line, I was like, oh, like to me, it seems like, okay, that's a very core point. And yet it wouldn't be enough to just have gone straight to that line. Like I understand everything that it says, that he's saying here, because I have the foundation of the book up to this point to help me understand it. So he's really done a great job of like building the book chapter after chapter, building up our foundation more and more. Anyway, back to failure. Ibram points out that for some reason their failure doesn't seem to matter. These failed racial ideologies, these failed strategies and solutions. Basically, because we believe so deeply in our racial ideologies that when a solution fails, we don't realize that it failed because it was based on a faulty premise. We think it failed because of some other thing, right? And then you try to fix that thing, but that's not the thing, so it doesn't actually work the next time. And it made me think, like, the analogy that came to mind for me was, like, if you have a broken water main, but you don't realize it, so you keep trying to fix other parts of the plumbing system. You try this, it doesn't work, so you try that, it doesn't work, and you keep doing it, and it still never occurs to you to check the water main. Because at your level of consciousness, the idea that the water main could even be broken isn't even in your awareness. Maybe the idea that there is a water main isn't even in your awareness. So, like in this analogy, you just keep fiddling with the pipes, these pipes and those pipes and so on, and you expel a lot of energy and get increasingly frustrated, and still the problem persists. Makes a lot of sense, huh? The way he explains this. And then to get more specific, one of the ideas that he focuses on as something that keeps getting tried and tried and tried and keeps failing and failing and failing is the idea of moral and educational and uplift suasion, which is basically the idea that if we can just appeal to people's moral conscience through horror and their logical mind through education, we will be able to create change. And Ibram argues that this has never been effective and never will be effective, with a series of what if questions. What if racist ideas make people illogical? What if persuading everyday white people is not persuading racist policymakers? What if racist policymakers know about the harmful outcomes of their policies? What if racist policymakers have neither morals nor conscience, let alone moral conscience, to paraphrase Malcolm X? What if no group in history has gained their freedom through appealing to the moral conscience of their oppressors, to paraphrase Assata Shakur? What if economic, political, or cultural self-interest drives racist policymakers, not hateful immorality, not ignorance? Whew. I don't know what to think of this, although I sense that he's right. It does kind of go pretty well against one of my core beliefs about humans, is that I talked about it a few audios ago, that like we are at our core really loving and caring. And if we've gotten away from that, it's because things have happened to make us get away from it. And maybe actually that idea and this idea can still coexist. He's not necessarily making an argument about human nature, whereas I'm talking more about human nature. He's talking about, you know, what the quest for power and for power over, which could still be argued that the quest for power over is a result of our culture and conditioning, not a result of human nature. Maybe. I don't know. That's a philosophical argument that could go around and around. but that's not what we're here to talk about today. Just something that comes to mind for me, because you know me, I'm always thinking about humans and why we are the way we are. Okay, so as this chapter continues, we finally get to something that feels like an answer to the question that I know many of us have been sitting with for this entire book, which is, what should we do? Because so far we've spent the book learning the answer to the question, what do I need to know to be anti-racist? And now we're ready to tackle, okay, now that I know these things, or at least I've had an introduction to them, how do we address racism? How do we become anti-racist? And Ibram's answer is, we change policy. And of course, this isn't a surprise, right? We knew that from the beginning, that that was the whole point of this book. But after the foundation that has been built, that Ibram built this entire book, at least for me, I feel like I'm ready to take it in on a deeper level. And ready to hear also Ibram's argument that we must change policy first and then change hearts and minds, or at least most hearts and minds. He writes that to fight for mental and moral changes after policy is changed means fighting alongside growing benefits and the dissipation of fears, making it possible for anti-racist power to succeed. To fight for mental and moral change as a prerequisite for policy change is to fight against growing fears and apathy, making it almost impossible for anti-racist power to succeed. So I was telling my husband about this, and he talked about seatbelts. He's like, yeah, that's exactly what happened to seatbelts as an example. And it got me curious, so I looked it up, and I found a recent article from Business Insider through which I learned that in 1965, Ralph Nader penned an expose called Unsafe at Any Speed, which spurred Congress to create what eventually became the National Highway Safety Administration, which required all vehicles except buses be fitted with seatbelts. And that happened in 1968. So before then, like, seatbelts don't really exist in cars, or they're an extra feature that you can pay extra for, but most people chose not to get them. But even after all cars were required to be fitted with them, using them was strictly voluntary, and most Americans didn't want to use them. The article said that as late as 1983, fewer than 15% of Americans said they used seatbelts consistently. But then New York became the first state to pass a mandatory seatbelt law in 1984. Other states soon followed. So policy changed before public opinion changed. But even though the policy had changed initially, the article states that while there was already clear evidence that seatbelts saved lives, these measures faced stiff opposition. A Gallup poll from July 1984 showed that 65% of Americans opposed mandatory belt laws. And so we see that if policymakers had tried to change minds first, like most minds, public opinion, they probably never would have gotten anywhere. And maybe we'd still be driving around no seatbelts like it was in the olden days. But when they started by creating seatbelt laws, which, by the way, now exist in every state except New Hampshire, the article pointed out that their license plates proclaim, of course, their state motto, live free or die. Little irony there. Anyway, public sentiment eventually changed, although it did take time. And the article actually was comparing seatbelts to mask wearing. And I won't get into all of that, but it's kind of interesting. So all that being said, one kind of lingering thought that came up for me as I was processing this chapter is, but it seems that we do have to change some minds before we can change policy. We have to change enough minds to get people with the forward thinking people into the positions to change policy, or to get the people who are already in those positions of power to think differently, right? So it may be ineffective to try and change most minds in overall public sentiment before passing policy. I totally get that. But don't the minds of policymakers need to be changed in order for policy to change? Or the minds of enough voters to vote in policymakers with different ideas? So, like, it's like there first needs to be enough forward thinkers, like enough, like whoever, you know, who, there's the people that come up with the new ideas. They're the forward thinkers. They have to change enough ideas for policy to change, even if general public opinion isn't there yet. And then after policy changes, we can work on overall public sentiment. So maybe it goes back to the tipping point idea that I talked about in last week's audio. And hopefully that's what's happening now as people are individually and collectively in groups like this, like learning, right? And maybe we right now, you and me, like we're part of this contingency of the pre-policy change thinkers, although there have been, there are some policies, right? There has been anti-racist progress. But then we need to enact a whole lot more policies to make more progress. So maybe like for those policies, we're part of like the pre-policy change thinkers who then use our energy to vote or put our money towards or otherwise support policy change. And then we can be part of the post-policy change thinkers who can potentially play a role in changing minds after the policy becomes law or becomes the rule. And maybe that's via kitchen table conversations, or maybe it's just simple ways we practice being the change we want to see. Like if it were, you know, 1985, we're the ones who just buckle our seatbelts. And if our friends and family see like, oh, a nut just buckles her seatbelt, it's not a big deal. Maybe I can just do that too. And in this case, like maybe it's the post-policy change is us doing things like doing our best not to get defensive or not to withdraw when we experience white fragility, right? Modeling that, being the change we want to see. And then people around us observe that and slowly public sentiment, like greater public sentiment begins to change. So anyway, I'm curious why Ibram didn't discuss sort of that caveat, which to me seems important, that you need to change enough minds first to get policy changed, and then you can work on everybody else. And maybe that feels like, I don't know, that feels especially important to me because I'm always wondering, like, we're doing all this learning here in the book club. I've been doing so much learning on my own. Like, is learning enough? And one answer is no, it's not, because nothing can really ever be enough in one sense. But also, like, yes, like, all of us here in this book club and me being able to facilitate it is changing our own minds, right? And that it is contributing to the solution. I hope. It maybe it's just in that way of getting a few more of us into that sort of pre-policy change understanding, right? So that then we can behave in the ways that I just explained a few minutes ago. Anyway, moving on further in the chapter, Ibram explains the difference between a demonstration and a protest. He says that a protest is organizing people for a prolonged campaign that forces racist power to change a policy. A demonstration is mobilizing people momentarily to publicize a problem. And this doesn't mean that a demonstration is bad or anything like that. It just, you know, he gives us some more info here. He says that a bit, he says that the most effective demonstrations, like the most effective educational efforts, help people find the anti-racist power within. The anti-racist power within is the ability to view my own racism in the mirror of my past and present, view my own anti-racism in the mirror of the future, view my own racial groups as equal to other racial groups, view the world of racial inequity as abnormal, view my own power to resist and overtake racist power and policy. The most effective demonstrations, like the most effective educational efforts, provide methods for people to give their anti-racist power, to give their human and financial resources, channeling attendees and their funds into organizations and protests and power-seizing campaigns. And then still later, he writes that the most effective protests create an environment whereby changing the racist policy becomes empowers self-interest. That seems to me a very important point to keep in mind. So if we want to change our racist policing practices, we must make it in the police's self-interest to do so. And to me, it seems obvious, of course, it's in their self-interest, because if racism within the police department, police departments were dismantled, it would make the police safer too. I mean, that I don't have data to back that up. It just seems like common sense to me, but also I could be wrong. I'm trying to be more and more careful not to make statements, present them as truth before I have like done the research and dug in. So take what I'm saying with a grain of salt. Always never believe anything I say just because I said it. Use your own brain, come to your own conclusions. Yeah. Okay. So the final main point of this chapter on failure is that Ibram emphasizes that when we fail, we must self-critique instead of blame others. And this is probably not a new idea for those of us on a conscious path, but still, it never hurts to have a reminder because it can be so easy to default to blaming others instead of turning the mirror on ourselves, at least in my experience. Something I need to remind myself of often. We want to be looking at what can I do differently instead of here's what you did wrong. Okay, let's talk about calls to action. This first one is a little complicated, so listen carefully, but hopefully it makes sense. My suggestion is to ponder, journal on, or have a conversation with someone on this prompt. Have I taken the time to reflect on each of my identities and how they intersect? And specifically, this is focused on race, class, gender, and sexuality. So it may help to first focus in on each identity, like looking at it as a separate thing, identifying specific ways that that identity either gives you privilege or oppresses you. And then after you've done that for all of your identities, race, class, gender, and sexuality, then reflect on how those identities intersect to create your experience in the world. So for me, this looks like reflecting on, as a white person, my life is different than a Black person's in the following ways. As a middle-class person, my life is different than a person who lives in poverty in the following ways. And then I could also extend that to my life is different from a person who has a lot of wealth in the following ways. As a woman, my life is different from a man's life in the following ways. As a cisgender person, my life is different from a trans person in the following ways. As a straight person, my life is different from a gay or lesbian person's life in the following ways. So kind of comparing each identity to the opposite or, you know, the other identities in that realm. And then bringing it all together. So for me, it would be like, okay, so being a white, well, half white, middle class, cisgender, straight woman, bringing all those together, and that affects my life. And basically, it's a lot of privileges, right? The only places where I come, like, and the less privileged part is being a woman instead of a man and being middle class instead of being super wealthy. Otherwise, compared to all the other identities, I have a lot of unearned privilege in my life that I have really been trying to become aware of and reflect on as a daily practice, because that's our work, right? Okay. And then my second suggestion for call to action for this week is to start to reflect on the question, how can I put the resources at my disposal towards anti-racist policy change? So that those resources could be money, it could be time, it could be skills, it could be lots of things. You know, and one thing I've been thinking about lately is that none of our resources belong to us. They're just things that we're given to steward. So like my money isn't mine. It's something that has been given to me to steward. Even my talents, my gifts, my skills don't belong to me. They are something that I have been given to steward. So those things, how can I put them? How can I use them towards anti-racist policy change? It's It's a big question. But it also is kind of the question, right? It's why we're reading this book. So let's start to think about it and brainstorm some answers. Okay, friends, this is a long audio, 40 minutes. I'm going to stop now so that you can get on with your day. But I am so grateful that you're here and that you are listening to me in your ear every week. What a blessing. It's something I'm really grateful for. You may have times where you're like, Nat, stop talking, like maybe right now. Or you get sick of me. And if that's the case, totally okay. That is totally okay. Yeah. okay. So I love you all. I appreciate you. And I will talk to you again next week. Mwah. Bye.